We do have a quorum, so the Government Operations and Elections Committee will come to order. Representative Quam, did you get a chance to review the minutes?
Yes.
Yes, I did, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the minutes.
Representative Quam moves the minutes of Wednesday, February 29th. Any discussion? Changes? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail. Got just one bill on the agenda, House File 2188. Representative Kiffmeyer, I'll move that House File 2188 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Judiciary. To your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate your time today and your hearing of House File 2188. I want to also thank the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities for their assistance and help in regards to this, and the Disability Law Center as they brought forward the idea and the concept of the guardianship and unlimited guardianship, and how helpful that has been. Also working with the long-term care providers and the aging services as well, and appreciate their time and effort. It means a lot to me, and it's very important that they be included in this discussion. And Madam Chair, one question I have for you. There are a couple of amendments. Do you want me to wait and present the bill as it is, or did you want process-wise?
Well, it looks like you have
to just go through the DE2 amendment, Madam Chair, would get the bill in the shape I would like to have, and that is the testimony that I have prepared is for that DE2 amendment.
Okay. Well, then I guess I would like to, if no one has an objection, to just go ahead and pass the DE2 amendment so it's in the shape that the author would like. That's all right with everyone? Okay. All those in favor of adoption of the DE2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. And now the bill is generally in your shape. Representative Nelson.
Just before we get started, there's the A2 amendment, and there's also an A1 amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need to put these on first, or do we want to discuss it before that?
What would be your preference, Representative Kiffmeyer?
Madam Chair, I would, and Representative Nelson, members, I would like to do these two amendments if we can. They did get to the committee later yesterday. And the folks that are here at their request to do these, I am very comfortable at supporting these two amendments to be added to the bill. The A1 is a request of the courts, and the A2 is a request of the long-term care providers, and I have agreed to them.
Representative Nelson, do you have a preference of how you'd like to handle this?
Why don't we put them on so the bill's the way we want it, so we can discuss it as the author intends.
Good idea. All those in favor, I will move the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. We'll move on to the A2 amendment. I think you said it was put on behalf of somebody. Do you want to talk about it just a little bit so we know what we're voting on here?
On the A1 and A2 amendments?
But just the A2.
Just the A2? The A2 amendment, sorry, Madam Chair, I will have that. I put them at the bottom of my, the A2 amendment addresses, I got it. The A2 amendment on line 1.3, the mailing must be addressed to the ward, and if applicable, the administrator or other responsible person at the facility in which the ward resides. Those who are under guardianship and live in a situation like this, if the mail is addressed only to the ward, in certain situations they cannot open their mail for them. And this is true with checks they receive, birthday gifts, and other things. So if they address it to also the administrator or other responsible person, it enables them to support the ward in their living arrangement. And this is the request of the long-term care providers and aging services to do this. That is in this amendment twice. The other one is 1.9. Following a determination made by the court under paragraph A, the guardian must inform the ward of the ward's current voting eligibility status. And what the long-term care providers wanted to be sure is that the guardian also informed the ward, because that would be a duty not only to inform the care provider, but also to inform the ward. And that's the duty of the guardian, and I agree to that. And it was inadvertently left off of the DE2 amendment. And so I took both their issues, that is in the A2 amendment, And I hope that's enough explanation at this time, Madam Chair.
It is. I think we'll go ahead and vote on it, and then people can still, once it's on the bill, people can still ask questions or testify right. to it if they so choose. That's all right. All those in favor of adoption of the A2, wait, I don't think I moved it. I'll move the A2 amendment. All those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Okay, the bill is in the shape you'd like now, Representative Kiffmeyer?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, why is this necessary? Well, there are a couple of letters from both the county attorney, Don Ryan, and also from a family member, Mrs. Dean, in regards to a vulnerable adult who was in a situation. And her letter and County Attorney Don Ryan's letters, both of them tell a very compelling story, both from the personal side of a parent as a guardian, and also from the county attorney being in a situation where the law lacks some specificity and some clarity in regards to this issue. And so in the State Council on Disability and Disability Law Center and bringing an idea forward regarding the concept of creating what is in current statute already as guardianship, but also a new, which is the concept is already in the statute, and that is a limited guardianship. And there are two good reasons for doing that, which is in the bill. One of them is the dignity of the person under limited guardianship, that they are able to be able to say to people, I'm under limited guardianship, expressing the fact that they don't need the full guardianship, but the conservatorship status, which is for financial, is not enough for them. It gives them that in-between place, which they qualify for, and also meets a very practical need. In addition, we have a constitution that says that a person who is under guardianship or a person who is insane or not mentally competent is not eligible nor shall be permitted to vote. And so we have that constitutional issue, and the current statute back in 2003 was reversed contrary to the Constitution. And so since 2003, that has caused an issue leading us to today. And so members, both aligning ourselves with the Constitution and the real practical issues for administrators such as county attorneys, and for family members, and just to let you know, I am a guardian for my sister who has a mental age of 3, and right now, according to current Minnesota law, I could take her to vote. She's not competent even to vote for her sister. All right. Thank you very much, and I appreciate that. And Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to go through the DE2 amendment. And so the concept is a guardianship to align ourselves with the Constitution, and then limited guardianship. If you note on line 1.9, it says, under limited guardianship, in which the court order revokes the ward's right to vote. That means that under a limited guardianship, there would be a presumption of the right to vote, and the court would need to take a specific action to take that away from them, depending upon their circumstances. So that is Section 1. Section 2 in the bill again carries that same concept into statute in section in chapter of law 201, and again follows that through the same concept in that particular area of the law, current law. In section 3, again repeating the same thing, guardianship and limited guardianship. At the end of section 3, on page 3, line 7, it says, a report required by the Secretary of State shall report at least annually to the chairs and ranking minority members of the House of Representatives and Senate committees with oversight over elections on the number of individuals in each county whose registration status is changed pursuant to this subdivision. I think for us as a legislature, when we change a law in this sort of way, it is good to have a report back to us so we keep track of what's happening. In Section 4, again, restating the guardianship, limited guardianship in Section 4, and that's the only change. In Section 5, which is the Bill of Rights for Wards and Protected Persons, on the second, on page 4, starting in line 430, pursuant to the Minnesota Constitution, Article 7, it restates the guardianship and limited guardianship concept in that area. And so in regards to the guardianship, limited guardianship, in the next section, section 6, realizing that when it comes to guardianships, there are four, and always three, but oftentimes four, key components. You will have the ward, you have the guardian, you have the court, and sometimes if the ward is not living with the guardian, you would in addition have the care provider. And so we need to make sure that all four of those are on the same page in this area. And so on section 6, on line 16, on page 5, line 16, it says specifically that in making an order, the court shall explicitly declare whether the order establishes a guardianship or a limited guardianship, and in the case of a limited guardianship, the effect of the order on the ward's right to vote. And so that involves the court then. They have a responsibility to give clarity, which they do, by the way, in every other area of a ward's life, health care, living arrangements, and everything else, and any other right they may have. And also, this just makes it so that it starts originally from a court order and gives clarity. On the next page, on the end of section 6, page 6, line 6, within 14 days after an appointment, a guardian shall send by certified mail a copy of the order of appointment to the ward's current residential address. And this is the section where the amendment that we talked about, if a ward's residential address changes, they send a new copy of the original order, that the address on that, that they would include the administrator or responsible person in addition to the ward. And so if we take on the 8-2 amendment, it says page 6, line 7, after the period, the mailing must be addressed to the ward and, if applicable, the administrator or other responsible person at the facility in which the ward resides. So that's where the A2 amendment fits in with that, as requested. All right. And we just want to make sure that the guardian, who is responsible for all other areas of the ward's care, also in this particular area, that we connect then from the court to the guardian to the caregiver, who need to have that knowledge. The next section, 7, it's a long section of law, so the next change to that section is on page 8. On page 8, again, the pursuant to the Minnesota Constitution, that is the same language as has appeared elsewhere, so that it's the same language. Section 8, which is on page 9. This has to do with the annual report of guardian. Every year there's a well-being report once you are established as a guardian. There's an annual report that goes from the guardian to the court, just in case there's changes, so the court stays in touch with the guardian to make sure that they touch base, because this is a very important area to take care of a vulnerable person and have that oversight. So line 15, the recommendation as to the need for continued guardianship and any recommended changes in the scope of the guardianship is there for all other rights of the ward and duties of the guardian, but one right has not been included before that needs to be there, and that's including whether, in the view of the guardian, the ward's eligibility to vote should be rescinded, restored, or continue unchanged. So it connects again the guardian, who has an opinion on all other areas, and this one they should do as well. On subdivision 2, on the next page, page 10, in the first section, working together with the guardian and the court, and by the way, the guardian also sends a notice every year to the ward saying, if you want to change your guardianship status, here's the address, here's the information, here's how to do it. And so that goes to a ward no matter what. And so in the annual review, that's one of the additional duties of a guardian. On page 10, on line 4, If the well-being report of a limited guardian under subdivision 1 indicates the changing conditions affecting a ward, oops, I think that needs to be okay. A little typo there. It should be the ward's capacity to make independent voting decisions. The court may issue a written order as to the ward's eligibility to vote. And that is able to be accomplished by the court, as they do now also. And the court must consider the limited guardian's recommendation, any documents, and so on, and affirmatively order that the ward's eligibility to vote is rescinded, restored, or continue unchanged. And by the way, this is subsequent to the initial order. So this is the thing that happens every year after you become a guardian and this process. That's the yearly well-being report. And we wanted to make sure that in this language on line 13, an order by the court under this paragraph may be modified by the court at any time. We want to give every opportunity to a ward who is capable of voting, even though it's in between that year, that can be done. The copy on line 14, it says a copy of the written order shall be sent to the guardian within 30 days of the date it is issued. And then the next part on line 16 is the limited guardian shall send by certified mail a copy of the court order or notification made by the court under this subdivision to the ward's current residential address. And again, that's the same language change here from the A2 amendment. The mailing must be addressed to the ward and, if applicable, the administrator or other responsible person. So that's the second place where that change occurs. If the address changes, the guardian shall send a new copy, so we keep current. And the requirements on line 21 do not apply if the guardian resides at the same address as the ward. In section 9, also on that B paragraph, after the period on line 22, the A2 amendment. Following a determination made by the court under paragraph A, the guardian must inform the ward of the ward's current voting eligibility status. That appears there. That's the A2 amendment. Section 9 has to do with the duties of facilities providing housing to a ward. The administrator or other responsible person overseeing a facility housing one or more wards must maintain the documents submitted to them by the guardian, maintain a written list, and also ensure that staff directly assisting wards in the voting process only assist those who are eligible to vote. And as used in this section, residential facility has a meaning provided in section in current statute. That's a common defined statute. The effective date for June 1st, 2012, the initial list required may be compiled on an ongoing basis as documentation is received by guardians as required by law. Section 10 is notification of voting eligibility status current guardians. By August 1st, 2012, the state court administrator shall provide to each guardian a notice restating the current voting eligibility status of any ward subject to the guardian's supervision. Be based on the order of the court establishing the guardianship or any subsequent order of the court affecting the ward's right to vote, providing that nothing in this section requires the court to reconsider a previous order or issue a new order related to the ward's right to vote for the sole purpose of providing the notice required under this section. And again, the effective date. And Madam Chair, on line 12, we would again insert the language, following receipt of the notice required under this section, the guardian must inform the ward of the ward's current. That's the second place where the A2 amendment also appears there. And Madam Chair, the additional language requested by the court on the A1 amendment is just a technical ability for the court in the conduct of their work to get the information that they need, and that's at their request. And so, Madam Chair, I appreciate very much the opportunity to present this bill. I do want to mention that there is a request by the Disability Law Center. We had a discussion about should we define, create a definition that might help give clarity, and they have requested to work with me on that. And so I will continue to work with them and others as well, Madam Chair. But with that, I believe I presented the bill and be glad to answer any questions.
Representative Kiffmeyer, on page 10.5, line 10.5, that looks like it's a typo affecting awards capacity. You mean a wards?
The wards capacity, yes, Madam Chair, that is a typo.
Okay, I'll just do an oral amendment then, that there be a space inserted between A and W on line 10.5, the word awards. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, we have a few questions, and then we have a few people that would like to testify. Representative Simon.
Sure, Madam Chair, I'll just wait until after the testifiers, but I'd like to remain on the list if I could.
Sure. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, I have received some correspondence and discussions with some groups, and they were just curious as to the how easy it was for any of the 23,000 who are under guardianship to transition to limited guardianship, and if you had an idea of what demand there might be for that.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Plum and members. We will make it as easy as possible for them in that transition, and I believe that the language we have here, especially with a letter restating any current orders, will greatly refine that number that might be in question very greatly. But I think we will do everything we can to make it as easy, and I think the language in this bill will help facilitate that.
Representative Kiffmeyer, did you have any witnesses?
Madam Chair, our witnesses, we had some tough weather up in the Brainerd area, so their ability to travel down, so the county attorney, Don Ryan, in lieu of his being able to be here today, submitted his written testimony. And Madam Chair, just because he cannot be here, I think that it's very important for the record to note that County Attorney Ryan supports House File 2188. A copy of this of the language was sent to him ahead of time so that he could know what was in this bill, that he is supportive, and he said it provides a vehicle for realignment of Minnesota law without undue disenfranchisement of an individual's right to vote. I think distinguishing a person under guardianship and limited guardianship clarifies the apparent current conflict in Minnesota law. And I think his statement also is that this bill does not radically alter current Minnesota guardianship law, and that was an important consideration that all the rest of the Guardianship Act is able, and they already mentioned in the Guardianship Act and current the concept of limited guardianship, so that's already there and is very helpful. We're just helping to clarify and define. And I think his other comments are supportive of the other components that are in today's bill. And especially for him, since there was a specific situation up in Crow Wing County of a person with a court order to not vote being taken by a care provider and voting, and Mrs. Dean as well, it was very, very disheartening to them because in every other case, dental appointments and all kinds of things, they were consulted as to time and what to do and what to happen, and then friends told them that they had noticed he had voted, and how could he have voted? And they were shocked to have been left out of out of this when they were included in everything else. So I think both the county attorney Ryan and Mrs. Steen's testimony is very much demonstrating the need and the importance of passing this bill.
Thank you. I think we'll move on then to the list of witnesses that we have. Is there Monty Jensen here?
Madam Chair, Monty Jensen called me this morning, and he is not able to make it his work schedule. They absolutely had to have him at work, and he regrets not being able to be here.
Okay. And then we do have a few people that wanted to speak, I think, in opposition to the bill. Justin Page from Minnesota Legal Aid.
No.
Good morning, and if you could just identify yourself before you begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Justin Page, and I am an attorney at the Minnesota Disability Law Center, which is a division of the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis. The Minnesota Disability Law Center represents individuals with disabilities across the state of Minnesota. First, I would like to thank Representative Kiffmeyer for working with our office and the Minnesota State Bar Association, CCD, and the Minnesota State Council on Disability to try to clear up any confusion out there between the language and the guardianship statute and the Minnesota Constitution. Under current law, individuals under guardianship have the right to vote unless the court finds that they are incompetent to vote and takes away that right. Minnesota's guardianship statutes were revised in 2003 to bring Minnesota law into line with the Uniform Guardianship and Protective Proceedings Act. Minnesota law provides guardians with only the powers necessitated by the ward's limitation and demonstrated needs, with the goal of encouraging the development of the ward's maximum self-reliance and independence. Rather than making a global finding of incompetence in all areas, the court will limit the guardian's powers to particular areas where the ward needs assistance after the ward's inability to make decisions in that area has been proven. An individual under guardianship is presumed to have the competence to vote and can vote unless a court makes a finding that the ward is incompetent to vote based on the evidence placed before it. The determination of incompetence to vote becomes a part of the guardianship order. The current statutory framework is in line with the court's valid exercise of their authority to preserve the ward's right to vote, even while finding incompetence in other decision-making areas. Prior to 2003, changes to conform the Uniform Guardianship and Protection Act, the law established two different types of guardianship or protective status. One, guardianship of the person, which was a limitation on all civil rights, including voting, and a finding of legal incompetence. And two, conservatorship of the person, limitations of only some of the person's civil rights and no finding of legal incompetence. Those under guardianship could not vote because their civil rights were restricted. Those under conservatorship could vote because only some of their civil rights were restricted. This change in terminology is important to understand because under the current statute, the term guardianship can be the equivalent of the old conservatorship of the person in that only some of the person's rights are limited. We understand that there is some confusion between the guardianship statute and the Minnesota Constitution, which provides that a person under guardianship shall not be entitled to vote. A potential fix to the apparent language conflict between the statute and the Constitution is to change the definition of guardianship in the guardianship, which House File 2188 attempts to do. This legislation will place wards in one to two categories, guardianship and limited guardianship. Currently, the bill states that under guardianship, individuals under guardianship cannot vote, and individuals under limited guardianship can vote unless the court specifically revokes the right to vote. We believe this statutory framework clears up any confusion between the guardianship statute and the state constitution. However, we believe that the terms guardianship and limited guardianship need to be defined in the bill, and we understand that Representative Kiffmeyer is open to our suggestions on that, so we will work with her. In addition, we also believe that there needs to be language in the bill which states that the presumption in law is that wards do retain the right to vote and have that right, which is consistent with the current law. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we look forward to working with members of the committee, Representative Kiffmeyer, the MSBA, and members of the disability community on improving the legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions specifically for this witness? Oh, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Page, or Representative Kiffmeyer. I guess the question I have has to do with we're changing the way a guardian, the way I read this, we're changing the way a guardian is defined. Is there going to be a whole bunch of guardians out there now who are actually limited, have the limited guardianship? They're going to have to get that status changed. Are we making it difficult for people out there that may not have had their rights removed, but they're considered a guard or a considered a ward, and now we're going to have to get their status changed to being a limited guardianship? I mean, are we creating hurdles for other for people out there that may have the right to vote?
Mr. Page?
If the changes that we would propose, again, we're working with Representative Kiffmeyer on potential changes, we don't think there would be any additional burden on the wards in making it more difficult for them to vote. But there might be some burdens, one-time burdens, on the court in administering this.
Representative Skelzy?
Well, I guess I'm just a little confused because it sounds like, I mean, I was kind of wondering if the concerns had been met by these amendments or if there's still work to do and should we be waiting until the work to do is done so that we know what we're voting on here. I would like to be more comfortable that we're voting on something that's completed. And when I hear somebody say we're going to continue to work on this, I don't know what that means. So maybe somebody could help me with that.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Scalzi and the members. I think it is important that just this morning I was informed by Mr. Page, and we've been working together all along. And the issue before this committee in government operations and elections are one area, but the next committee that we would go to, there's a couple more, is judiciary, where the 524 chapter in regards to guardianships and some of that is that particular committee area. So I feel that the things that are especially pertinent to this committee in government operations and elections are addressed. And by the time we get to the judiciary committee, since I only knew about it this morning, there was not something, I didn't want to do something last minute, but in judiciary committee, that is their particular area of purview. And we can do that. We already have a working relationship.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, Representative Kiffmeyer, thanks for your flexibility. It sounds like you've been working with a lot of different people. I'm sure there are a lot of moving parts in a bill like this, so I really do appreciate that. I guess, you know, Mr. Page sort of touched on what I was going to ask, which is about making sure we have solid definitions in here, because this is potentially, of course, a really big change. Looking at the DE amendment, I'm just trying to sort through this on the fly. Because right now, of course, under present law, it's under guardianship in which the court order revokes the ward's right to vote. That's line 1.8 through 1.10. So right now we have a situation where they can vote unless something else happens. The presumption is they can vote. And this for a full guardianship would reverse the presumption, so now the presumption is they can't vote. That's the starting presumption. But I understand you're adding this new category, which seems on its face to make sense, of a limited guardianship. I guess the key question, at least for me, and maybe I'm just, as I'm looking at the DE amendment, is making sure we have a good definition of what that means. And it sounds like that's what you're working on. So I don't know if you care to comment about.
Sure. Representative Kiffmeyer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Simon. When we discussed doing a definition earlier in talking with Mr. Page and others as well, and we had like, do we need a definition? It's already in the guardianship bill. And but I thought we had it down as to saying I don't think we need more of a specific definition. It's only just this morning that it seems as though there's a thought that that might be good to do. And so it's not an unfamiliar concept. I just don't want to do it on the fly this morning.
Representative Simon.
I'm sure that's actually very helpful. Could do either of you, do you have, what is the citation where that, do you know the section of law where there is the current definition of limited guardianship? Is that what you're saying, that there is one, we might just not need to import it into this?
Madam Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
And Representative Simon. It's conceptually in the Guardianship Act, but not necessarily defined. So it mentions limited guardianship and unlimited guardianship in there, and it's part of when we met and we talked about that, but I think Mr. Page can answer that way better than I can. I just thought I'd give you a little background.
Mr. Page?
I know Bob McLeod is going to testify in a little bit, and he would be able to answer that question.
Okay.
But I believe.
Sorry, well, he's actually next on the list, so perhaps we can move him up now, unless anyone else had.
Helpful.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, I'm sorry before I didn't mention Mr. McLeod in our conversations and meetings. We have talked about this before, so it's not an unfamiliarity to have him here today.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. McLeod, and if you could just identify yourself for the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Robert McLeod, M-C-L-E-O-D, and I am appearing today strictly in my own individual capacity so that there's no mistaking that I'm here on behalf of the Bar or the Probate and Trust Section, mostly because I do so much work with them. I don't want there to be any confusion of my role here today. I have submitted or asked for submission of a statement that I would ask added into the legislative record that summarizes my full analysis of this particular issue. Briefly stated, if I may, just why would I care about this legislation? Just briefly, I was the secretary of the committee that drafted the 2003 legislation. I was the co-chair of the legislation committee when it's brought before this legislature and passed. I wrote the book on guardianship conservatorship law in Minnesota. I wrote all the court forms, and I wrote the court manual that's currently on the court website. I have been twice recognized by the MSBA for my work, as well as by the Minnesota Supreme Court in the area. This has been an important focus of my practice throughout the years. My basic point before you today is this. I don't believe we should change the presumption of voting. The Constitution talks to people under guardianship not having the right to vote, but early case law clearly states that it is this legislature that defines what guardianship means. The word guardianship is not defined in the state constitution, and this legislature was vested with the power to determine what it means. And early on, guardianship meant incompetent, which is different from incapacity, and those two words cannot be confused or blurred. Incompetent means pretty much what you might think it means, other than your brother-in-law. It means you are wholly lacking in abilities, where incapacity means various disabilities of some sort, but many people are incapacitated, are probably may very well be sitting next to you. They're fully functional people. And in 1973, this legislature created a second form of guardianship called conservatorship, where this legislature recognized that not all persons who need the aid of the court are incompetent, that some are incapacitated. And this court created conservatorship of the person in 1973 and specifically said that a person who is incapacitated retains the right to vote. So it was a specific recognition of incapacity retains the right to vote. In 2003, when we amended the statutes, we specifically, willfully, and deliberately stopped calling anyone incompetent. It wasn't necessary. Now, persons are only declared incapacitated. And we presumptively gave them the right to vote, which is a presumptive fundamental right of every single citizen of this state. But the law also provides, if a person is so incapacitated that they cannot vote, then the court can take the right to vote if necessary. So there are safeguards to prevent people who are wholly incapacitated from voting. The safeguard is there. But the presumption is, if you walk into a Minnesota courtroom, you are possessed of all fundamental rights. Period. and it is the court's job or the job of the state to prove otherwise. My concern with the legislation is that this would reverse the presumption. It reverses the presumption, but it says, if you're incapacitated, prove to me that you can vote. And I don't think that's the job of the state. The job of the state, the state should carry that burden, not the citizen standing before the court. That's my great concern, and I know this is legal issues may be best kept before the civil law committee, and I appreciate that completely. But I just wanted to state that as my fundamental concern, that persons with disabilities, even when within the court process and court supervision, should be presumptively thought to possess the right to vote. And that's my current concern. And I also want to be very clear, and I want to thank Representative Kiffmeyer for being very, very open with us and open-minded and willing to work with us. And, you know, oftentimes when you disagree with someone, they can shut you down and just stop talking, and that has not been the case at all. And I sincerely want to thank the representative for being so cooperative. But that is the primary point that I want to present to the court this body today, and I would ask that my written statement be admitted into the legislative record.
We do have that. Members of the packet. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McLeod, thanks for coming. I hadn't seen this before the hearing, but this is really an impressive document. I urge members to at least look at it wherever you are on this issue. You've really, in painstaking detail, kind of sketched out the history here, if nothing else. I'm intrigued in particular on page 10 of your handout. This Missouri case from the Eighth Circuit, which of course includes Minnesota within the Eighth Circuit, which seems to at least to sort of settle the idea that a court can, that despite the fact that Missouri is one of the four states like Minnesota that has this guardianship mention in terms of eligibility, they said it's okay, it's not unconstitutional, it's not inconsistent to have a court, in this case the probate court, order that person still has the right to vote. Can you comment on that a little bit? Because that's something that would, in case of a court challenge, in case people think there's ambiguity, in case someone wants to sue to say, for example, that Minnesota's letting people under guardianship vote who shouldn't vote, in case there's a lawsuit, at least if it's in federal court, because we're in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which Missouri is as well, isn't there a pretty good likelihood, based on the case law, that the court would say there is no contradiction between the current regime? There's no contradiction between our language and our Constitution and what courts regularly do, which is say, under certain circumstances, people under guardianship can vote, or they presumptively can vote. Is that, am I getting that right?
Mr. McLeod?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Simon. That I think that's fundamentally correct, that this particular court said, like ours, it said a person under full guardianship does not have the right to vote under the state constitution. But in this particular case, the court specifically provided that the ward retained the right to vote. And so in that situation, the court held in that case that the state constitution is not facially unconstitutional, at least just on its broad face. And there is a current federal lawsuit that has been filed with regard to some of this issue. It was filed recently, within the last week, Tuesday. That is really raising many of the same issues. So this will begin to come to a head, but I think following, if the analysis is similar, that I would think a court would also find that since our state courts provide that a person under guardianship retains the right to vote, that it's not facially unconstitutional. But I would like to point out in this case, the court gave the person the right to vote while under full guardianship. While our statutes, I would arrogantly like to say, take the higher road of saying, we presume you have the right to vote, and it's for us to take it away by the rightful proof. And I guess that's just the focus I'd like the statute to run in. But yes, I hope I answered your question.
Representative Simon?
Yeah, just one other comment, too, about your memo here or your document. I think, and this sort of underscores the reason why we need definitions in here somewhere, and I'm glad to hear that the stakeholders are working on that. If you look, I think, on page 7 of your document, under section 4, you know, I've just been, again, on the fly, like every member of the committee, sort of glancing at this, but I think you do an excellent job of describing how that term has changed over the years, starting back, you know, even before state vote in 1851. And if we're going to use the sort of original intent concept, which is the Justice Scalia kind of preferred approach, where you look at the intent at the time of the Constitution, it's important to know what these definitions are. What did guardianship mean in the 1850s versus what it does now? And even if you don't buy into that, I think it's important. This is a moving target, and it's important to make it more fixed. If we're going to do something as potentially drastic as reverse the presumption, in other words, from now on, it's not you can vote unless dot, dot, dot. If the opposite is you can't vote unless dot, dot, dot. If we're going to do that, we better have fixed definitions about what guardianship and limited guardianship mean. Otherwise, we may be creating more problems. Do you care to comment on that?
Ms. McLeod?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Simon. Yes, I do agree, and that's why the definitions, I think, are extremely important, and the representative has expressed the willingness to provide such a definition to provide clarity. And I do agree that the definitions are important. But also, I again want to emphasize that things do change. Our original state constitution deprived persons of color the right to vote. Our original constitution deprived American Indians various rights to vote. It deprived a lot of people the right to vote, but as we as a nation and as a state have grown and improved upon things, and I would like to just see that continue to move forward.
Madam Chair, I might address
Senator
that
Kiffmeyer?
I think in response, and I think that this is where we agree. I think it's a matter of the wording, and but in the concept of preserving everybody's right to vote and giving that very opportunity, and in the language, I've tried to make that sure. There's a lack of clarity here, not so much that we just want to be sure. And I want to say to you that to say that there's no problem right now is not quite accurate. As a practitioner and looking at the current situation, we have about 23,000-25,000. We're not quite sure exactly what the number is of guardianships. But right now, on the current rosters in Minnesota, we only have 36 listed. And so there's a little bit of a communication going on here, because in order to get to the point of guardianship, you're usually in a situation that you have some need. And so I think we do have some documented needs here as far as what can happen. And I think that this bill preserves those rights to vote and yet helps to give clarity to all the complexity of the parts, from the ward to the guardian to the court to the care providers, and how important it is to connect them all in this process. But absolutely in every way in my bill, I've tried to demonstrate that intent to preserve the voting right wherever it is due them, and to preserve their process as it is due them. And I think that we can accomplish that. And I think in considering those definitions and doing that and having that, I'm very amenable to working with Mr. McLeod and Mr. Page to accomplish that.
Representative Simon?
Just on a factual point, I just want to make sure I understood, Representative Kiffmeyer. You're saying there are only 36 people? I thought I heard you say out of the 23,000-25,000 people under guardianship, there are only 36 on the rolls. Is that what you were saying, or did I misunderstand?
Representative Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Simon. At this time, from the Secretary of State office, it is that mark of challenge on the roster due to guardianship status, 36.
Representative Simon.
Okay, so as I understand it, that's 36 who have been challenged. That's not to say that there are only 36 people under guardianship.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Madam Chair and Representative Simon, yes, that's my point, that there's a communication issue here as far as this data and clarification is needed.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm sorry if this was addressed when I was not in the room, but I just want to make clear, and the witness, I think, has made clear that his interpretation of current state law is that people are presumed to have the right to vote, even if they're under conservatorship or guardianship. And there has to be some finding that incapacity that they have is sufficient to justify their lack of a right or their inability to vote. Is it your intention that the law will still presume that people are able to vote or have the ability to vote unless there's some showing that they can't?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, when I take a look at this, in order for any guardianship, limited guardianship, conservatorship, it always comes to the court first to make the determination by evidence provided and other things that go, excuse me, that go along with that proceeding. At that point, when the court makes that determination, the court needs to be clear about the voting status and that the guardianship, again, definitionally added as well, that if the court is placing a person who has that need in the guardianship title, that means that the other rights and the voting right, in particular, under guardianship would not be included. But if the court, again, making that determination, all starting from the court, and I believe the court has the presumption, all rights are there until the court says otherwise. And so if the court places them in a limited guardianship, the court has an additional decision. Do they preserve that presumption of the right to vote, or is it taken away? In either case, whatever the court does, to be clear about it, and that the court would make that determination, and the court has all those options available to them.
Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Representative Kiffmeyer, is it your intention to have other rights bound up with this question of guardianship versus limited guardianship, or is only the right to vote the difference between them, or is that the only right involved in the difference between those two forms?
Representative Kiffmeyer?
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, the only right being dealt with in this bill is adding clarity to the voting, but all the other rights are already in the Guardianship Act. They're all there. They're all addressed explicitly already. And so there was no need to touch on anything else because those are already there. The only right that wasn't clear or explicit was the voting right. And so when the court does its order in regards to everything else, they just need to make that clear.
Well,
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I guess it seems to me you're introducing a new definition and therefore a new concept into statute, which is the limited guardianship. Because right now under Minnesota law, all guardianships are based on not a finding first of incompetency, but based on incapacity, and it's a varying degree of incapacity, and it's based on the individual. So if we have these kind of two definitions, and we're introducing this concept in state law, it seems to me we might be affecting things beyond voting, that there may be other ramifications despite our intentions in the law. So the question, I guess, is this something that you think needs to go to the Health and Human Services Committee, for example, to consider it before we move forward? I know that your intention is this, but often unintended consequences happen when we pass election laws, and it seems to me that other committees might be better able to determine whether or not some of those issues are raised by this bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Representative Winkler and members. Yes, you weren't here when we discussed that. In the current Guardianship Act, no changes to that. The concept of limited guardianship is already there. And they also make reference to an unlimited guardianship. And that's already in this. And when the Minnesota State Council on Disability staff person and the Disability Law Center, Mr. Page, brought the fact that this is already in the Guardianship Act, and that this might be a useful concept that's already there, that we could just add clarification to it in regards to the voting status and clarification from the court and everybody communicating what that is. But that is already in the Guardianship Act, the concept of limited guardianship.
Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm having trouble squaring your statements about this with the statement that Mr. McLeod has offered us. And, you know, I guess that's one of the challenges we face here is dealing with these documents as they come out. But I guess I'm just concerned that it's my understanding that we're adding definitions to provide clarity under voting, but that those definitions are not the same, those are not used in the same way in the rest of guardianship law. And so maybe I'm not understanding the witness's statement here, but it just seems like there's some inconsistency in how we're treating voting standards versus other guardianship standards. And if we're doing it the same, then we are changing the out, or we may be creating unintended consequences for other rights beyond voting under the guardianship laws.
Representative Winkler, this is going to Judiciary next, and it is my understanding that the HHS Policy Committee is looking at whether they need to see this. So I think those discussions are underway.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and that was actually, that was sort of my first question, whether this is going to be going to HHS.
Yeah.
And I think that would be a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, just to respond to that, I requested that and talked to them because, yes.
Mm-hmm. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going back to the question that Representative Simon asked, and you said that, and I guess I want to get my head around this. You said there's 2,500 people under guardianship, and according to the Secretary of State, there's only 36 that have been flagged on the voter rolls. Are you assuming that other 2,500 are registered to vote, or are they just not registered to vote? I mean, what's the assumption there? I mean, it could be that they know they're not supposed to vote and they're not registered, and there may be 36 that may be recent or that haven't had their names taken off the voter rolls yet. I mean, what's your assumption there?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, first of all, that number is about 23,000 to 25,000.
Add a zero.
A few zeros in there. Yeah. Yes, I know. You got that other. And that is the question. I agree with you. I think, what we know is just a fact right now. We just know factually that is challenged on the roster due to guardianship. Some of those other questions are also, but in current Minnesota law, it does require the courts to communicate guardianship information to the Secretary of State office, but it appears that in this situation, that the communication that they have is 36 right now. They have inactives, which is 74, and deleted 55. I don't quite understand totally. I believe the inactives, not quite sure just what that means, but it's just a classification, just a factual piece of information. And then the deleted is usually meaning that due to death, usually, that once you have passed away. But as has been the process since 1998, that we don't purge anymore the election data every 4 years and purge everything before that. Nowadays with storage and all that, that this information is good to have, and storage not being an issue. So they have those deletions of 55. I would take an educated guess to say that is probably due to a death record of some sort. But these are just facts that we have here right now. And currently, it is 36 out of those 25,000.
Now, Mr. McLeod, I have a question for you. Did you get a chance to look at the letter from Sharon Stenny?
No, Madam Chair. No, I did not.
Well, it's basically a mother whose son, she says, was put in a group home and, basically had the court tell him everything that he needed to do, and that she says James is severely retarded. And she found out, came to understand that her son had voted and that the group home had taken him to vote even though he wasn't at a mental stage where he could vote. And I'm just wondering what you make of that, and if you could maybe comment about how that happens. I've gotten anecdotal emails that said the same thing, and I'm just wondering what you make of that, and if you think that's a problem, or I'm getting confused about what kind of information the group homes are getting that would allow them to either decide that they should bring someone to vote or not bring someone to vote. And I'm just wondering if you can kind of comment on what you make of this letter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The fundamental point is punish the criminal and not the victim. In general, constitutional-wise, we don't discredit the vote. We penalize the actor. But the vote is a sacramental. It needs to be preserved. And if someone is abusing a vulnerable adult, well, by all means, prosecute them. But I think you're getting to the practical point of why does this person have the right to vote? Well, if they shouldn't vote, it's a very easy process to have that vote taken away in the sense that you asked the court to take the exceptional step of taking the right to vote by saying, look, here's this person, here's his medical records, and this person doesn't have the capacity to vote. And then the court can take the right to vote, and then that is supposed to be put on record with the registrar of voters that this person can't vote, which I think is a constitutionally safe and good governance system. But so I think there are two questions in there. One, the practical question is, well, if they really can't vote, then have the court declare that they can't vote and have that recorded, and then the person is not supposed to vote. And two, if someone is abusing a vulnerable adult, by all means, prosecute them. But I don't think the answer is, well, let's just take the right to vote from everyone who I might question has the ability to vote. That is a bad presumption to work from, and that's the presumption I fear.
And Mr. McLeod, would you then think that the better way to go then would be to strengthen the section of law that talks about the prosecution so that the group homes would understand that there was you know, if they took a person in who was not qualified to vote, that there would be penalties to pay? Would you think that would be a better way to go about this supposed or this alleged problem?
Just shooting from the hip, my general shooting from the hip is yes. And I think there may also very well be laws already in place that do prohibit such behavior. And I don't know if this was the same case, but the one case was brought before a grand jury, and I believe the grand jury failed to indict. And so the process worked in the sense that a criminal action was potentially taken. It was brought to the authorities, brought before a grand jury. No indictment was issued, and it moved. I think that's what happened in one of the particular cases. I don't know if this one. But my point there is being fundamentally the system worked in general the way it's supposed to. But certainly if informing group homes and other institutions with the care of the vulnerable saying, don't do that, I think that's a good thing. Anytime we train and teach people of how to properly care for and preserve the integrity of the individual, even if that may include they shouldn't vote, is a good thing.
Right. Yeah, because I feel like if this is happening, it's probably because they don't understand how serious it is.
I agree.
And that's what I'd like to see addressed. Representative Kiffmeyer, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I do. I remember when I asked the question about this process with my sister, and I was told, hire an attorney. And to expect people to go out and hire attorneys to get the knowledge, I'm in an unusual situation where I can have some of that knowledge and some of those financial means. But to expect 23,000 people to go out and hire an attorney when there is a solution that can be taken care of. The other thing is that one of the reasons for the lack of indictment was failure of the law to clarify and be specific. And that is why the county attorney, the prosecuting attorney in that case, supports this bill, because it will give him that legal grounds in which to get that indictment for the abuse and manipulation of somebody. And he felt that if this bill is passed, this will greatly help him to protect the vulnerable who may be manipulated and abused in this situation. And it disheartened him greatly. But because we didn't have some language that we have in this bill right now, he felt he was left with a situation where they didn't have an indictment, even though most reasonable people and a common sense person would say this was an abuse. I mean, this is a situation in which we have an affidavit, sworn affidavit, that observed this person in this situation being in a very, very mental incapacity situation, being in the absentee voting at the county courthouse, that was overheard repeatedly, this is who you vote for, and to the point that when the vulnerable person left the actual little ballot booth and left the area, the caregiver stayed in the voting booth and was observed continuing to mark the ballot. So this bill would have helped the county attorney to do that kind of prosecution that you're talking about. And I think it is really important that we protect those from that, because not only is there potential of abuse and manipulation in this situation? But if that caregiver is doing it in this area, what about the other areas of duty and responsibility that shows a lack of character here that they may also be failing or might be manipulating and abusing? And this is a concern, and that's why I believe the county attorney supports this bill and its process.
Madam Chair.
Mr. McLeod.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to support Representative Kitzmeyer in those comments. I'm all in favor of protecting the vulnerable, and if the county attorney has problems with that, I just want to be clear. I'm all in favor of that.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, reading the letter from Sharon Steen here, I guess maybe your assumption is going that they did a criminal act here because they took the person to vote. And I think the amendment, the A2 amendment, takes care of that. I think my assumption is maybe they didn't know. And I think part of the amendment here you've got here is that they make sure we notify those homes, the ward, the guardian, and the home that they're at, that they're not able to, are not supposed to go vote. Because if I'm working in that home and I don't know, and I'm assuming we got to take people to vote, it may just be a simple mistake that the person, because I wasn't informed, I don't know. And so I think the amendment that we put on takes care of that, but I'm not just going to assume that because they took them to vote in the 2010 election, the person that took them to vote may not have known that they weren't supposed to go vote. And I don't want us to go into the assuming that they created a criminal act because they didn't know, they weren't told.
Right.
So they did what they thought they were supposed to be doing.
Right, and it seems like that's what the bill is trying to do, and that's what I'm trying to get at, too. If you work at a group home, how do you know whether or not you can do that? Do you want to comment to that, Representative Kiffmeyer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Nelson. I believe it does. That is one of the pieces. It's important for the guardian to know. It's important for the court to be clear because of a bit of confusion between prior 2003 and post-2003 and some of these real instances we have. It's shown that it is an issue, that will exactly be very helpful. Matter of fact, just one of the reasons why the county attorney couldn't get an indictment. So you're exactly right that this will be helpful.
Okay. And then I have a couple more member questions, and then I'd like to get back to the witnesses, if that would be okay. Representative Winkler.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, and Mr. McLeod, actually, I have a follow-up for you, too. Representative Kiffmeyer, could you show us where in the bill that the influence of a caregiver or improper influence of a caregiver over a person under guardianship would be addressed? So if somebody's saying, here's who you vote for, or here's where you vote, or if they go into the voting booth with them, and that's an abuse, where in your bill is that addressed?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, current law already has a section for undue influence. And so there's no need to deal with that. The big thing here that the county attorney said that he couldn't get an indictment, obviously was some undue influence here, but that the caregiver said, well, I didn't know. My presumption, Representative Winkler, is that if you're there with somebody and they leave the polling booth and you stay there and continue marking, that's way beyond even undue influence. That is marking the ballot when the voter has left. And so even common sense would kind of be able to tell you that. But the county attorney said because they just used this defense, well, I didn't know. That was the key issue addressing here. The undue influence is already in statute.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, no caregiver has a defense to a criminal charge that they didn't know that they were breaking the law.
My case in point.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I agree with you.
Good. So then the prosecutor trying to bring the case and bring it to the grand jury couldn't get a conviction, not because the caregiver didn't know they weren't allowed to have undue influence. And I haven't heard any statement that this individual was actually ineligible to vote.
Madam
Representative
Chair,
Kiffmeyer.
In fact, in this situation, not Mrs. Dean's son, is a situation, but there are other cases in that same situation. This isn't the only one. There are other vulnerable people who did have a court order to not vote, who were taken to vote. All right. So the problem is that because of the change since 2003, there's uncertainty and a lack of clarification in making that change effective all the way through to the caregivers.
Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Representative Kipmeyer, if we kind of get through the muddle of facts and issues here, the only issue raised by this case in Crow Wing County, apparently, is that the caregiver didn't, other caregivers, not this one that we're talking about, but other caregivers didn't know if people were permitted to vote or not. And if you wanted to resolve that issue, then the notification sections of your bill would be sufficient. So long as people are, the caregivers are informed of the right to vote, of the people they're taking care of, and as long as we already have standards for undue influence, then there's really no issue raised here. The person had the capacity, or you know, hadn't had the right to vote removed. Mm. He may or may not have had an undue influence issue, but if that was an undue influence issue, the county attorney could have prosecuted for that under current law. And if there were other cases where the people were not eligible to vote, the caregivers weren't informed, and then there should probably be some notification requirement. But creating these two levels of guardianship does not in any way address the issue raised in Crow Wing County. That's completely separate. And Mr. McLeod, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm looking at page 8 of your handout. And the bottom paragraph, it says, a person under guardianship retains the right to vote unless such right is taken by the court. So under current law, a person under guardianship has the right to vote unless the court has made some determination that they lack the capacity to exercise that right. And if the court has made that determination, a communication of that court decision could be made to all caregivers. Is that correct?
Mr. McLeod?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, yes.
Representative Winkler.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, just kind of getting back to the basics here. In Minnesota law, you are presumed to have the right to vote. If you were placed under guardianship using the incapacitated standard, which is what we've had in place, the court will determine whether or not one of the things you're capable of doing is voting. If the court determines that you are not capable of voting, your right to vote is removed. I think that satisfies the constitutional requirement. If your right to your eligibility to vote is eliminated, that information under your bill could be communicated to the caregiver. So I would support the notification section of your bill. Notify the caregiver. Under current law, if the caregiver brings the person to vote and engages in some undue influence, we have laws to prosecute them. So this whole chain of issues and facts and kind of, you know, this whole chain of issues and facts and kind of, you know, assertions really just comes down to one little issue, which is that the caregivers apparently weren't notified about who could vote and who couldn't. And that's a really simple bill. I think we could all agree with the rest of this. It really doesn't add anything. And I don't understand why we would kind of open up this whole can of worms again instead of just focusing right down on this question of notification, which is the only fact that we have to deal with.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Winkler. I remember a Supreme Court justice telling me it is constitutional and that it is constitutional until a court says it's not. And so I just rely upon a plain-faced reading of the Minnesota State Constitution, and I don't think that my bill conflicts with that, and I think that if there is additional clarification needed, I've expressed my desire and willingness to work with others on that additional clarification.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, my point isn't that your bill is unconstitutional. My point is that current law is constitutional. Current law has the only issue, the only concern that you've raised about current law is the lack of notification of certain caregivers about who can vote and who can't vote of the people they're responsible for. And it seems like that's what we should narrow this whole bill down to, is that one issue. Everything else works. According to your testimony, at least there's nothing that you've suggested to say that doesn't work. And if we don't have an adequate notice, then we should provide that. Sounds pretty simple.
Representative Kiffmeyer?
I'll be glad to answer any other questions, Madam Chair.
Okay, just a second. Representative Quam has been waiting patiently for a long time, and then...
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Winkler touched on a point that I think I could clarify. If you look at the letter from the county attorney, justification for this legislation, and the second line, well, in the first two lines, this bill addresses the apparent conflict between federal law, Minnesota Constitution, and Minnesota statutory law. I think the discourse we've had this morning exemplifies that there is some interpretive issues, and it would not be the first time that statute was passed and needed clarification. And I see this piece of legislation allowing clarification, assisting the courts and others of the state to more clearly understand the delineation of the legislation and compatibility with the Constitution. And if you look at the section of the Constitution as amended, I think it was in 74, in that section, along with the guardianship, is statements of treason and felons of where civil liberties are restored. So therefore, my interpretation, consistent with that section as amended, is that guardianship, you lose that, and that our legislation would allow for the courts to restore that civil right and other rights with limited guardianship, of where you're delineating what rights and duties are given up to the guardian from the board. And I think that is maybe a more appropriate interpretation. And I think that's why I support this bill, is I hate to have legislation cause confusion. And I think this helps set up a situation where the courts can easily define partial guardianship, that limited guardianship, because as we know, each individual is different. But when you do have the process of guardianship, that is protection for the ward and the state. And this bill allows us to delineate and grant back. And I do trust the courts being able to ascertain which rights the guardian would be given and which would still be reserved to the ward through, due process and whatever testimony. So I support this amendment, this bill. Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, you've just described the law as it is right now. To get under guardianship, you have to show that a person is incapacitated, which is a variable determination depending on individual, and it depends on different things that they can do and not do. So that's what we have. And the person gets to vote until a court decides that they're not capable of doing so. That's the system we have. I don't really, there's no conflict. The only conflict is that the Minnesota majority wrote another report, and so here comes another bill. That's it.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought we took an oath to abide by the Constitution. Therefore, inherently, the Constitution is a higher level of a law and restriction. And because of the verbiage in the Constitution, we are just adding that flexibility. I think your interpretation is inferring that there is not that restriction in the Constitution, and that the legislation is at level or above the Constitution. And so I start with the highest law that we legislate to, and that's abiding by the Constitution. And since it states, you know, I think clearly to me, I think the legislation should be compatible and not infer something that's opposite the verbiage in the Constitution.
Madam Chair, I just want to thank Representative Quam for pointing out that the Constitution is superior to statutory law, and just thank him for pointing that out to us.
Representative Scalzi, and then, before you go, though, I do have, I'd like to get the last few people on. I know one of them is a private citizen, and before we get too far, we could do that. Representative Scalzi.
Very briefly, I'm wondering, I mean, Mrs. Steen is the guardian of her son, and I'm wondering where, why she, I mean, I don't know if anyone can answer this. This is the case we're looking at. But certainly she could have told someone at the group home without being required by law that he shouldn't be voting. I don't know where, what fell through the cracks, but, you know, her statement, who is going to protect my son and other vulnerable adults? Well, it's her, because she's the guardian. I don't know that a group home worker is the proper one to protect this person from voting when the mother is the guardian. That's her role. Somebody dropped the ball, in my estimation, and do you see what I'm saying? I mean, I just don't know why it's got to be written into law and somebody else's fault when this mother dropped the ball by not telling the group home.
Well, Representative Scalzi, I mean, to me it looks like she had no expectation that her son would vote because it didn't seem as though he was capable of voting, so she seemed to be very surprised that they would bring him in. It doesn't appear that he requested to be brought in or anything like that, so... Representative Kiffmeyer, maybe
yes.
You'd like to add.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, first of all, Mrs. Dean is sending this letter in place of her husband died. So after this incident and they became aware of this and she couldn't be here today, and so her husband, Al Steen, who died, and they're in the process of getting guardianship to her, but you know, as families, you do this together. Mm-hmm. There is no dropping the ball in any way, shape, or form. They were consulted on every other detail of their son's life. Why would they think that on this one they wouldn't be also consulted or informed or discussed? And to say they should just go hire an attorney and figure that out and do all that is putting a lot on a family. But in this particular case, I just want to say that when Mrs. Dean is sending this letter and telling her story, and she's not here to give anything more than just telling her story, to accuse her of dropping balls or failure, I think is an unfair characterization of her and her family. And they are wanting to make every best effort to help do this in a way that they would have. That's why the part where the guardians are connected in to having a say in that, in a very simple, already done, well-being report, it's already there, that we incorporate in that. It wasn't there before. And so to think of, for them to say, well, it's so obvious, but that she just didn't think of it, and now that she is aware of this situation, she's coming forward. But I think to characterize her as failing or dropping balls is very harsh to her. And also she, I think, I'm not quite sure if in her letter she says, but it's her husband that mainly held a lot of these responsibilities and passed away last fall. So they're just in process of changing. I can't speak for Mrs. Dean. I mean, it's a letter. It's there. I just want to defend her in some statements.
You know, I didn't say that she didn't do her job. I'm just saying that as a guardian, she could tell, and every case is different, and certainly she has lots of things going on in her life, but she's the guardian. I guess I better not say anything because I don't want to be chastised for words, but she is the guardian, and I'm very fortunate. I've never had to be a guardian for anyone because I'm sure it's a very tough job, as you well know.
Well, Madam Chair, I can just clarify.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
But she is the guardian. That's all I'm stating. So,
well, if it was just, yes, and I appreciate that. But in every other area, which I think the previous testifier said, you don't take rights away unless the court says so. And in this particular case, there was, in her particular case, not in others, but in her particular case, there was no statement from the court of taking away that right to vote. So there was no easy way for her to approach that and the knowledge. So for her, going to an attorney, what she did is aware of the situation. She's talked with the county attorney, or her husband did, and all this whole process. She's just trying to honor her husband, who had more to do with this, and just being a voice for their son, Jim, and for her husband in the situation, reflecting it to the best of their ability. But previously, rights don't just get to be taken away by even a guardian. It's a court statement in regards to those rights.
And I think there's some clarity on that line there where she says, we were asked permission for and signed papers for decisions on doctor visits, dental visits, vaccinations, eye doctor appointments, and many other decisions. I think she just didn't know it was going to happen. Is it to this point, Representative Winkler? Representative Winkler?
Yeah, well, I mean, Madam Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, the guardianship removes certain rights, or it transfers rights from the individual or the ward to the guardian. And one of the rights not transferred was a right to vote. And it may have been surprising to this mother, and it may have been surprising to this father that that's the way the law worked. That's understandable that it could be surprising. But their surprise, or their lack of knowledge that their child retained the right to vote, doesn't mean that we should change the law. The law, because the law says the person has the right to vote until the court takes it away. If there's a question about notification, we can fix that. But the surprise or the unawareness of this family that the child retained the right to vote doesn't mean that we should be changing the laws and taking away this presumption of a right. I don't understand how any of this bears on that. And they may have been consulted on a whole number of issues, but it is fundamentally the guardian's responsibility to know what rights have been transferred to the guardian and not. As difficult as that might be at times to follow through and understand it, admit and take care of.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
And Representative Winkler, and every other right, the court is explicit about exactly what they have and don't have. The only specific area where the court is not explicit one way or the other is in regards to the voting right.
Thank you. If it'd be okay, I hate to not get to the witnesses that have come here before. Could I have Rick Mons come up? He's still here. No, and then, Ms. Holstein, would you like to testify? Or you don't have to, certainly. You're just on my list here.
Hi. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Heidi Holstein. I represent Care Providers of Minnesota. We are a trade association that represents nursing homes, assisted living, and other housing with services type settings. We also want to thank Representative Kiffmeyer for working with us on the notification pieces of this bill, and in particular commenting on Section 9 of the bill and the A2 amendment. The A2 amendment was requested by us. Our members, when we talk about this issue, we're deeply concerned that we, as the administrators or the housing managers, would be in the position of telling the ward about their ability or non-ability to vote. And so we appreciate the provisions of this amendment beginning on line 1.9, that it is the guardian's responsibility to inform the ward of their voting status, eligibility status. And then the first part of this amendment is something that we just realized yesterday, and that is we can't open the mail necessarily of the people who live in our settings. And so if we are required, as Section 9 says, to maintain a list and to collect the documents in regard to guardianship status, then we need to be able to get a direct copy of that. So there may still be issues that come up However, at this time, we thank Representative Kiffmeyer for working with us, and that is essentially what I came to say.
Okay. Thank you much. I have Representative Beard next on my list.
Madam Chair, I've just been sitting and listening to the discussion going back and forth, and I just want to make a comment from a perspective that I haven't heard here this morning, and that's, I don't want to sound selfish, but it's my perspective. I have a vote. It's one vote, and that's it. As I understand the situation happening in Crow Wing County, it sounded to me like somebody who ran a ward full of folks who had no comprehension about what they were voting for actually were able to influence many votes, however many that was. That's of grave concern to me. It sounds to me like this bill is trying to get back to clarification that somebody who might bring ballots in to a ward where people don't have any comprehension of what's going on should somehow be prevented from exerting that kind of influence in a close race anywhere. Doesn't matter if it's a close race or not. One person gets one vote, and they should all count equally. And my concern is that people who aren't the guardians somehow are able to influence one other person, many other people. And that has an impact on every voter in the state. I think that's why this is a serious subject that merits some clarification. And I guess that's really all I have to say. Just a thought.
Senator Kiffmeyer?
Well said, Representative Beard, Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, I think that concern could be a legitimate concern, but this bill doesn't address the question of influence. It addresses the question of eligibility. And the argument was about notification, about who was eligible. So if we need to improve notification, I think that would be something that this bill addresses. What this bill does not address is the question of influence. And Representative Kiffmeyer has already said that there are laws in the books to deal with undue influence. And so this bill has two components. It's eligibility and notification about eligibility. And there hasn't been any testimony, any discussion, or any reason to suspect that current law related to eligibility is in any way deficient. And so that's why I think we should narrow this. I can't do it on the fly because the sections are put together, but I think we should just focus on notification because that's the issue that's been raised that this bill addresses. It doesn't address the question of influence.
And it looks like we've got a couple other committee steps. Maybe you can work with that. You know, I actually just have one question. Now, this has been such an interesting discussion to me. And this, I think, Representative Scalzi's question about, you know, who's responsible. And I'm not very familiar with this area, and I'm just wondering, or maybe this is even a question for Ms. Holstein, I'm not sure, but I'm trying to figure out the process of, okay, it's election day, and the people at a group home say, I want to go vote, please take me to vote, or is it a case where the group homes are saying, okay, everybody, it's time to vote, let's go vote, and let me show you who to vote for. How is there any requirement that a person under guardianship asks to vote, or how is it that they find themselves at the voting booth? Is there anything that clarifies that, Representative Kiffmeyer?
Well, Madam Chair and members, the situation you have is if somebody's under a guardianship, a court order in some way, and they do not have the right to vote, it is because they lack mental capacity to either make an independent voting decision and are in that situation. They don't have the capacity to do that. That's why the Constitution put it in there that to deal with that and gave a court process to go through that. And so if they're in a situation that they might be in a living facility that others may be voting or doing something like my sister would be, she wants to kind of go along. Not because she understands what's happening, not because she's even eligible or legally entitled to, but remember, they don't have the same capacity as those of us sitting here in this room today. So they may be in those situations. That's why it's incumbent upon the court, the guardians, and the caregivers to have clear orders, clear lines of communication, clear responsibility for each in their own way to follow out the orders that are there as in a protective way for them as vulnerable people.
Well, thanks. I think we've had a very long discussion. And, Representative Nelson, do you have another question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess this a little bit, this is prompted by what the discussion's been going on, and I agree with Representative Beard that the vote is important and that we each of us want to make sure that the people's votes, is everyone's vote counts equally. And I have concerns about the undue influence, but as we've heard in testimony, that's already in statute. So I don't know if that's a worry here, and I don't think that's what this bill's getting at. And as I stated earlier, I like the part, the amendment with the notification. I think that's what we're getting at, is notifying so that the group home is notified, that the people there know that they're not, that who is not supposed to be able to vote. Because I guess I'm looking at this, again, the letter from Ms. Stein and about her son, and I guess just turning that around on its head, what if her son had the right to vote and the group home he was at refused to take him to vote? Wouldn't that also be prosecutable, interfering with a person's ability to vote if they wouldn't take him to go vote, if that was their duty as being in that group home? So I guess that's a concern I have here, where I think, as Representative Representative Winkler pointed out, I think what we need here is we're looking at is getting better notification of the people so that we know who is. And I think a lot of this other stuff is going beyond what is necessary to deal with the problem of making sure that the people who aren't supposed to be able to vote are not taken there to vote, and the people that are in care of them know that they're not supposed to vote. I think notification will handle that without having to go through the other steps that are in this bill. So that's what I wanted to say.
Okay. Madam Chair, I don't know if you're finished with the testifiers or anything else at this time. I do have a closing, but I just...
Madam Chair, I believe that I contacted the...
My name is Ben Ashley Wortman. I'm Policy and Outreach Associate at Mental Health Association, Minnesota. Apologies for the confusion. I believe I emailed the committee assistant. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for hearing our testimony. We have two serious concerns about the bill as it stands. Our first concern is for the potential for confusion. The language as currently used is clear and concise. It is easily understood by those who are affected and concentrates at the relevant fact at hand. Does the person have the right to vote? The new language is not as clear and contains an additional question that must be answered. What kind of guardianship do I have? Perhaps it is clear to us in this room, but it may not always be as clear as it is interpreted by the voters and election judges around the state. I have always appreciated the seriousness with which they have taken this oath when I have observed them or interacted with them. They solemnly detail the prohibitions involved and the need for me as the voter to swear to those facts with total sincerity. These election judges have erred to caution when there were any questions of eligibility or established residence. We ask that election officials and the public be allowed to keep the language as they have it now. It is clear, it is understood, and it works. We believe that a person coming to the wrong conclusion, voting improperly despite having their rights revoked, or deciding not to vote despite retaining those rights, is more likely with the new language. And between those two outcomes, we believe that the latter is more likely. These disenfranchisements will be quiet. They will not be reported to the Secretary of State under the Help America Vote Act. They will simply be people around the state who will resign themselves to less involvement in their community because they no longer believe they have a right. Based on the proposed language, we are uncertain of what would happen to a person already under guardianship. Would their legal status be automatically changed to limited guardianship if they had previously retained the right to vote? Wouldn't this need to be ratified by the court? We are concerned that a rush of renewals would invite rubber stamp applications that do not encourage maximum self-reliance and independence as the current statute requires. We lack language and statute to help guide the courts and individuals on what limited guardianship would be. And we are concerned that this redefines the category of guardianship, which now requires the least restrictive means necessary to take the meaning of highly restrictive. The second concern is with the annual reporting mechanism, when many guardians have limited knowledge of their ward's abilities or incentives to underestimate what they are capable of. I believe that this committee or the legislature has heard testimony on this issue, that Commissioner Justin is legally responsible for many, many guardian wards. Sorry. This might be the high number for the state, but she is not the only one with multiple wards. We have a great level of trust with loving family members and good social service organizations who undertake this work, but there are less noble reasons for a person to become a guardian. A person might go into it for profit only and have 40 or 50 such wards. Cases of abuse are widely known and reported. Taking away the power to vote is one more way in which a ward can be unfairly treated. There are already financial incentives for a guardian to say that a ward needs to remain as such. Why not add that a person is incapable of voting? The courts have provided a level of review insufficient to prevent financial and other abuses that they have seen. They make decisions as best they can in limited amounts of time. We are concerned that taking away the presumption may encourage guardians to say no, to err on the side of taking away more rights. The law for Minnesota guardianship procedures call for the least restrictive means necessary, something we at MHAM want to celebrate. People with mental illnesses, even if they require guardianship, still have a great deal of knowledge about what they want to have in their lives, what they want for themselves, their communities. This bill may create additional confusion and formally remove the right to vote from those who have held it previously. We respectfully ask that this bill not advance from committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions here? Okay, well, we've come to the conclusion of our committee time here, so unless there are additional questions, Representative Kiffmeyer, I know you wanted to wrap up. If you could make that quickly, I know members have appointments and whatnot, so if you could just wrap it up quickly.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members, and I ask for your support of House File 2188. The absolute effort and preservation in here is to preserve the rights of every person that is entitled to vote. It preserves that right to vote. It preserves the fact that the court will be the only entity, that there will be influence to the court, but there will also be only the court that will have the authority to take away the right to vote and any other rights that are currently enumerated. But there is a lack of clarification, and it is important that this start with the court. The court has a duty to be clear, because all the other notifications stem from that court order, and is very, very important. There are opportunities here to consider more, and I appreciate that, but remember, it says, in making an order, the court shall explicitly declare whether the order establishes a guardianship or a limited guardianship, and in the case of a limited, the effect of the order on the ward's right to vote. The presumption is under limited guardianship. And just to mention, when this was brought to me, the dignity of the person, because when you say I'm under guardianship, most people's assumptions are a little different. But when you say I'm under limited guardianship, there's greater dignity to the person. And especially those who have that mental capacity to vote and do a lot of those things, that dignity of their person in regards to limited guardianship is one of my motivations. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I ask for your support.
Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2188 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay?
No.
Motion does prevail. And meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.